Board Game Bros.
Hello, listeners.
Hey.
It's another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew Craig.
We're brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games, board game design, gaming as a hobby, all things tabletop, board gaming, card gaming in general. And this is one of our regularly scheduled weekly episodes where we discuss one game in particular. And this episode's going to be interesting.
Yeah.
Because
for the most part, we've been pretty positive on a lot of the games.
Yeah, we usually approach every episode with a pretty positive mindset, minus maybe one or two. But even then, there's still...
Usually, one of us likes it, the other one doesn't like it as much.
And even when one of us doesn't like it, we never really dislike it. It's just, like, to a certain extent. Maybe the closest we've gotten is actually our first episode, Catan. But even then, you know, we had a lot of positives to balance out those negatives. But today, we have a game that the two of us dislike a lot.
And from what I can tell, it's a very divisive game in the community. Mm-hmm. This is, of course, Munchkin.
Yes, we're talking about the dungeon-delving card game Munchkin.
Designed by Steve Jackson and published in 2001 by Steve Jackson Games.
Mm-hmm. Did it win any awards?
Think it won like a 2001 Origins Best Card Game Award.
Mm-hmm.
Origins being the game fair / convention held every year. I think this Origin happened just a week ago.
Mm-hmm.
Also, it has at least 16 rethemed editions, a board game remake, a comic series that was published in, I want to say, 2016, and a t-shirt and bookmark, among other things, that can affect the game.
Recently, oh, that can affect the game.
Yeah.
Of course, yes. This game is pretty wacky with its peripherals and other out-of-game related things. Also, we did also recently, not recently, but in one of our first Good Stuffs episodes, we talked about that there is a competitive card game version of Munchkin.
Oh, yeah, vastly there is different. A Munchkin trading card game that came out recently.
Right.
And that was designed by other designers.
Yes, and it's vastly different from the original Munchkin. Yeah. So today we're going to talk about original Munchkin, right out of the box, as it was designed long ago, in 2001. This is one of the earliest games we've reviewed, I think. Maybe Catan comes close, but even in North America, I think in North America alone, this is one of the earliest games we've reviewed. So Munchkin. Here's a short description of Munchkin and what it's about. In Munchkin, players are members of a fantasy adventuring party attempting to backstab their way to the top. On each player's turn, they kick down the door of a generic dungeon. They find in the dungeon monsters, traps, and loot. When a player is fighting a monster, all other players have the option to either ask to help them, usually for monetary gain, or they can work against them by casting spells and using items that strengthen the monster. Players start at level 1, and when a player defeats a monster, they gain a level, and the first player to obtain level 10 wins. Essentially, you can expect a game of Munchkin to go like this. You work your way up to level 9, you desperately collect as many items as you can along the way, so that when you are fighting for your coveted 10th level, you have enough defenses to withstand the barrage of hate from each and every one of your opponents. Or, conversely, you reach level 9 second and go for level 10 when your opponent's countermeasures have been exhausted on someone else. That's the basics of Munchkin. You're an adventuring party working against one another to be the first person to reach level 10. But you're not necessarily always working against one another. There's times when you can wheel and deal to get a couple things here and there for helping other people. There's a social aspect to the game.
And with that, we go into the strategy of Munchkin.
Yes, and a greater description of how to play. Although a greater description is not necessarily needed. You really just need to know that there is a dungeon deck which has doors on the back. I think they're called door cards in the game. And then there's loot cards, which have a hoard of treasure on the backs.
Yeah.
And you separate them into two separate decks. Everybody is dealt a couple cards from each deck to start the game. And then game continues how I described, with one player taking their turn kicking the door down, which means drawing the top card of the dungeon deck and doing whatever it is. If it's a monster, they have to fight it. If it's not, if it's a trap, then they are affected by it. If it's something else entirely, then they get to add it to their hand and fight a different monster.
I believe if they choose. If you have a monster in your hand, you can just choose to fight that instead,
no.
right?
Nope. No. In Munchkin, really? You have to fight the monster if it is the card that you kick down the door and reveal. If it's not a monster, then you have the option of fighting a monster from your own hand.
Then you have that.
Yes, option. but usually you're just fighting the monsters from the top of the deck, unless you don't draw one. Then you play one from your hand if you'd like to.
All right.
But it's optional.
So yeah.
You defeat the monsters, you collect the loot from the loot deck, and that's mm-hmm. the sort of gameplay loop that occurs.
Yeah. And the way you defeat monsters is each monster has a power or a level.
Mm-hmm. It starts at 1 and it goes all the way up to 20, although there's only really 120. Then below that, there's, I think, like an 18, a 15. There's just one of each of these high numbers. Yeah. Most of them exist in the low numbers between 1 and 10.
Yeah. And you combine your level with the additional power granted by your items or your loot.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you have the higher one, you win. If not, then bad stuff happens.
Yes.
By bad stuff, I literally mean each monster card has bad stuff written on it.
Yes.
And it can defer as to what it does. Some of them don't kill you. Some of them do.
Yes. Oftentimes, the lower level ones will just cause you to lose a level. Or sometimes some more creative options, like losing specific types of items. For example, I think the goo on the floor, that monster will cause you to lose your shoes. Or maybe I'm thinking of a trap that does that. Either way, usually it's just losing one or two levels if you fail to defeat a monster. The bigger end monsters will cause you to die, which is a thing in the game where if you die, you reset back to... I don't think you reset your level.
I don't think you reset
your
level.
No, you don't reset your level. Yes, you don't reset your level, but you lose all of your items. Some of your items are given away to other players, and the rest are discarded. They loot your body, essentially.
Yeah.
For whatever they can carry.
Yeah.
Yes, but yeah, that's the general gameplay, how you play. To describe some of the cards in the door deck, which is kind of a perplexing combination of cards.
Yeah.
There are the monsters, of course. There are special abilities that usually you can only play on the monsters. For example, there's a bunch of cards that can grow or shrink monsters. The ones that grow monsters larger will allow you to win more treasures if you're able to defeat the monster. There's also the Wandering Monster card, which you can play to add a second monster from your hand to the combat. And then there are the classes and races. So this is like a typical dungeon delving adventuring type of game. So you can expect all the regular dungeon delving adventure classes and races to appear here in a fantasy game. You know, there's a warrior, there's a thief, there's a wizard, there's a cleric,
elf, there's dwarf,
elf, dwarf, halfling. I don't think human is. I think human's the base one.
Maybe.
But elf, dwarf, elf, dwarf, halfling. And I think that's it for races.
There might be orc, but I'm not sure.
No, I think orc comes in a later expansion.
Oh, yeah, sure.
but yeah, so the races and classes are mixed in with all those other cards. And sometimes you draw them and you can use them to augment your character. You can only have one class at a time, but there's some cards that let you have two. You can only have one race at a time, but there's also some cards you can have two. And then there's all the items. So the different items you can get, the ones that you mentioned earlier, the equipment, are usually just a straight up bonus to your power level, which is your level of your character plus the power that is granted to you by your equipment. There's also a lot of just single-use items like potions that will usually grant somebody in a combat a bonus to their power level. You can use that on yourself in your own combats, or you can use it on the monsters in other people's combats if you want to set them back and backstab them. So now let's talk about the whole concept of backstabbing.
Oh, wait, hold on.
Oh, what?
I did want to say that the items each have a slot they go into.
Yeah.
So you have two hands, you have your feet, your, I think, head,
mm-hmm.
and then is there a chest?
Torso.
Yeah, torso.
Right, so you are quite literally equipping your character, and you obviously can't stack items on top of each other.
Yeah.
And then, items also have a dollar value or a gold value. And you can exchange 1,000 gold worth of items on your turn to gain a level in this game. This cannot be your 10th level, but any level before that, you can use this money to gain. And it's that's the only way that gold is used in this game, really. You don't use it to actually collect, like, as a resource and then spend later. You just discard enough gold worth of items to reach that 1,000 benchmark to get you that level on a turn all at once. There's no, like, actual marker for gold. So let's talk about strategy, yeah. All right? I have a couple of things written down for strategy. Obviously, this is a game about backstabbing. So you oftentimes want to be holding on to things that you can use on your opponents when it really matters, because that 10th level is how you win the game, and it's where everything is laid on the line, and you want to, as often as you can, try to save those potions and those monster modifier cards till that moment, because if you use them too early, then you won't have them when it really counts, because that's when the game ends, and if you can't stop the game from ending, then you've lost, you know?
And so if you can just beat all the monsters you run into, great, you're mm-hmm. just gonna level up seamlessly then, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
If you cannot, then that is where the bartering with, like, paying other people to help you comes in.
Right.
So, thinking about it from just a number sense, I think an average about how much power you would expect from an item is maybe 3.
It's, I think, 2.5.
Two and a half.
Because it's like low end items give you 1, high end they give you 4. Yeah. So, like, 2.5 is about what you would expect.
So, I think usually if you take either how much of a level the person's getting, you know, like if it's like 1 level early game or 1 level late game, that's a bit of a different thing. And then if you're helping them, you usually want, you know, like an equal amount or more mm-hmm. in treasure. So I guess a better way to put it would be if they are fighting a monster that drops 2 items, you probably want to try to get both.
Mm-hmm.
If they're fighting a monster that drops 3 items, I think, but then still 2 or 3, usually you just want all the items.
Yes.
And I think this is a big part of the game, because knowing when to ask for help and knowing when to help people for a different, you know, amount is important.
It's a big part of the strategy in this game. Because if you can manage it, you don't really want to help people.
Yeah.
Because it gets them closer to winning. And by not helping, they're not getting closer to winning. That's incredibly good for you. So the only, really, I would say the only reason you should help people is if you're hurting for the items.
It's if you're hurting for the items, or if you want them to reach level 9 before you do.
True, you can use that as sort of a tool.
Is that,
now, we should probably take 1 second just to explain how helping works.
Yeah.
Because it's an important mechanic in this game. It's very crucial to a lot of the strategy, and that is that when another player is fighting a monster, now, you can use your items to help a player, as in you can, like, use your potions to boost the power of the player, but that gives you nothing, really, except maybe an ally, which can quickly turn into not an ally in this kind of game. But what you can do to get direct help is, or to get direct compensation for helping them, is you actually help them as a character. And that means your character participates in the fight. They add their power to the power of the person fighting the monster, and it helps to defeat the monster. But this is a thing that you offer to the player who is fighting the monster, and usually you always want to be asking for a reward for helping them out in any case. And like you're saying, yeah, you usually want to get all the items.
As large of a reward as you can.
Because
if you need to reason with them and they're initially hesitant, just say that, like, if you help them, then they won't get the bad stuff, and they will get closer to winning.
Exactly.
Items don't technically help you win, so you can always
They don't progress your state as a character towards a winning position.
You can fast talk.
Exactly. So, So the items are technically more important because they have a higher strength to them when it comes to defeating more monsters in the deck, but yes, it doesn't win you the game, and so there's an argument that you should make every time you offer your services. All this said, it's very easy to undercut opponents in these situations, and if you're really hurting for items, that's when I suggest you do the undercutting and you say, I'll do it for just one item.
Yeah.
In addition to this, there's a negotiation knob that you can turn, which is who decides what items get taken and given to other players. So, you know, if you need to make your position seem a little better than somebody else making the same proposition, you can always say you can choose which items get taken. Or you can say, I'll take one item, but I get to choose which item.
The classic cake cutter's dilemma.
Yes. And I mean, technically in this game, it's not wrong to offer the exact same deal as somebody else, because the person who's fighting the monster ultimately gets to decide who he allows to help them. And they could choose you over the other person, even though both of you have the same offer, just because maybe you are further behind than the other person, and it would be less risky to allow you to catch up with some items.
Honestly, any outside factors can influence whether or not who gets help and for what amount.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, really, it's just up to your playgroup to really delve into those.
And
I mean,
it's up to you to really, really sell yourself as a good helper. It could be like,
if you're the one hosting the board game night, you can always say, hey, if you don't help me, I'll kick you out of the house.
Sure.
And at that point, I mean, I question why you're playing board games, but at the same time, that's what Munchkin is.
Yeah, that's kind of what Munchkin
is. They encourage players to go crazy and treat the out of game as part of the game and vice versa.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. There's a lot of that to this game. A lot of that kind of humor and joking around and that the meta game around this game.
So really,
is kind of lighthearted and also a little nasty.
Yeah.
And you can use that to your advantage if you want. It's a political game. There's a political aspect to it. And it's like sort of hinted at in the theming of the game. But really, you know, just take it as far as you want. If it means winning, if winning is so important to you in this game. I will say I have three notes here. I have be an elf, be a cleric, and save the doppelganger until the very end.
So I do want to add something to that. I think cleric is the most relevant end game.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's literally a card that says all clerics gain a level.
So, yeah, and this can be the game-winning level. So, essentially, in the game, the last level has to come from defeating a monster, unless you're a cleric and you gain a level from this very specific card called Divine Intervention.
Yeah.
And Divine Intervention just says, as soon as this card is drawn, you have to play it. All clerics gain a level, and if this would be the 10th level, then the clerics win.
I think otherwise, Wizard's the best class during the game.
Mm-hmm.
Like, early to mid, because they can manage resources much better, because they have, like, a polymorph ability that lets you, like...
You can discard your whole hand in order to charm a monster, is what it is. And when you do so, you get all of the item rewards for beating the monster, but you don't defeat the monster, you don't gain the level, you just get all the item rewards. It's very good when you're fighting strong monsters.
It's especially self-sustaining.
Yes, especially if the monster would give you three or more items, because then you're netting positive. Especially,
it completely circumvents the whole negotiation aspect.
Sure, yeah, you don't have to do all that, you just win. And it circumvents any tampering from your opponent, unless your opponents add a wandering monster, because wandering monsters have to be resolved separately of a single monster, so you can charm one, but you have to defeat the other in that case. I think the thief is also quite a good class,
right? They can steal for from the other mid-game. Players.
Exactly, they can steal from other players, meaning in a combat once per player, I believe you can discard a card from your hand and roll a die. And if you roll a 4 or higher, which is a 50% chance on a 6-sided die that they come with in the game, then you steal the item you chose. And you can steal some very powerful items this way. It's a 1-for-1, but it's generally better for you because you're discarding a card that's worth less than the item that you're taking. And the thief has the backstab ability, which is the easiest way outside of playing item cards to tamper with your opponent's power levels, because they can discard up to 3 cards to affect an opponent, I believe. It's either 1 or 3, I can't remember. But either way, you discard a card, you give an opponent -2 power, which is a pretty decent ratio. No, you can only do it once per combat. You can only do it once, but -2 is not a... It's an important number, I guess. It's It's not nothing.
Yeah.
It's something.
It's actually two.
And it can, and it can also kind of clinch an end game, but the cleric is definitely the better option in the end game. And you want to be an elf because the elf has an ability that says when it helps another person, and the elf also gains a level. Normally, when you help someone, you only get whatever items they agree to give you, and you don't get anything else. You don't get a level for helping to defeat the monster. Only the person fighting it defeats the monster gets the level, unless you're an elf helping. Then you get a level. So elf is a better early game race because sometimes people won't have any other choice but allow you to help them. Sometimes you can lowball, you know, helping fees in order to get that early level because it'll be less of a deal early on, but then later on, obviously nobody's going to let you help them because you're getting too close to the end game, but hopefully by that point you've gotten enough value out of your elf that you can get a different race later on. But elf is very good beginning of the game. Cleric's very good late game. I also mentioned the doppelganger card. There's only one of it in the base game, and it just straight up doubles your power when you play it. So you just want to save that until the very last combat with a monster, because that's the point when everybody's going to be dumping all their potions and modifiers that are making the monster bigger and stronger and harder to defeat. And the doppelganger is the only thing that doubles power in the game. Everything else is just a flat bonus. And by the end point, your power is so strong that the doubling it with your doppelganger is just such a huge, insurmountable bonus to your own power that people can't stop it. Plus, if you play anything on top of it, all your potions that you're playing on yourself to buff yourself up, those are also going to get doubled by the doppelganger in the end. So if you draw the doppelganger, just sit on it for the whole game until you can win.
Yeah.
Yes, and one last thing is kind of the way that the game works. It's sort of like a first come first serve type of deal when it comes to whether you want to play cards onto the monster. Usually I think you use a timer of sorts, just so that people don't take too long thinking about whether they want to play something to affect a combat. I think it's like, I don't know, 4 or 5 seconds or something like that. But you do want to give your opponents a minute to play their cards before you start playing your cards when it comes to these like late game rushes to stop someone from winning, because you don't want to blow everything in your hand, especially if you have potions that you can use on yourself rather than just on the monsters of your opponents. You know, you want to hold on to those and try and get other people to play out their cards in their hands, so that you are left with some resources to work with on later turns.
Right.
Yes. Do you have anything else to add for a strategy?
Not really.
Yeah, there's not much strategy to this game because a lot of it is left up to chance. So let's start digging into the design of the game. And this is where I think we're going to call it a sympathetic roast of the game. It's sympathetic because this game was made in 2001. And I think a lot of the things that that a lot of modern games have to them that lead to a more balanced and fair experience for all players involved, a lot of those conventions and design decisions, plus a lot of the just general design decisions and like levels of complexity and understood things between players in between games, like just a generic player knowledge, all that has changed since this game was made. And so this game does a lot of things that are unnecessary, that lead to a poor gaming experience. And we know better now.
Yeah, there's a lot of that just feels like a product of its time.
Yes. So let's get into the design.
Yeah. Okay. So
where do you want to start?
I want to start with a basic sort of fact that Munchkin has difficult wordings.
Okay.
I say this because the wordings of the cards, as far as their effects, what they do, can range. It's either like very liberal in what it does, or very like, just, I don't know, very vague. It ranges. So like if a card, I can't have any examples on hand.
Maybe, well, I think one thing you could say is that there's no clear method of resolving things in the game, yeah. Which is one problem. You know, when it comes to those end game, pile all your cards on top of something and stop someone from winning, it can get a little hectic and confusing. And
you don't need something like Magic where you have a really in-depth system for how to resolve things.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of games just have the, you can only have one card, do its effect, and then you can play another card.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of just, yeah, weird things going on.
Yeah, it's also kind of like the language that you use and what a card effect does and how that can sometimes conflict with what another card effect does.
It has a lot of room for interpretation, and the game outright says that, like, if you don't know a ruling, make it up.
Yes.
Which is a big problem when you think about, like, going to shops and conventions and playing with people.
Mm-hmm.
Different people have different understandings and different house rules.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of a big thing for me. I think it's funny, there's one card that its name completely, like, does not match its effect, and it's telling that we played it wrong for years.
Mm-hmm.
It was the Help Me Out Here card, which lets you borrow an item from a player, but we always took it to mean another player has to help you for no reward. So it was like, well, I guess that's, I mean, I think the art was kind of like that, of like somebody trying to pull a sword from another person's hands.
Mm-hmm.
But even then, I think it just has this weird, you know, wordage of like, it's kind of vague.
Yeah.
Also, sometimes it's kind of literal, like the fact that, you know, you have two hands, so a two-handed weapon fits in both your hands.
Mm-hmm. I think it's funny that rule exists in the book, that if something is up for interpretation, just make it up. It would make sense in a more loose kind of party game where a lot of the game is just revolved around like people talking about what's actually happening.
Right.
But I mean, in this kind of game and in a lot of modern games where there's, you know, there's math involved and stuff like that, it's like, it's a little odd that they would have to put that in, but I guess they did because, you know, the game design philosophy, I guess, or
yeah, I guess also, like, spreading rulings might have been more difficult back then, you know, having to look up Munchkin rulings on Usenet or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I mean, nowadays there's a lot of very centralized places where you can look up what a developer or designer meant when they made a card or something.
Sure, yeah, certainly games these days still have some problems even like this.
On BoardGameGeek, you can almost always talk to the designers, they're usually on there, mm-hmm. to get direct interpretations, but I think, you know, it's just another product of its time thing, which is going to be what a lot of this boils down to.
Mm-hmm. I think two important things that Munchkin is missing that a lot of games put a great deal of focus on these days is pacing and catch-up mechanics.
Yeah, so Munchkin is a very snowball-y game,
mm-hmm.
but it also doesn't give much room to the people that fall behind.
I mean, I think both of these problems, or one of these problems at least, comes from the fact that of how the door deck is constructed.
Yeah. The door deck both has the best cards in the game and the most devastating cards in the game.
And it's just shuffled together, and there's pretty much no, I don't think in the main game, there's absolutely no way of filtering through it.
Yeah.
It's just whatever you draw on your turn, that's what you get. And if it's a level 15 monster that kills you and takes all your items away. Now, they did manage this a little bit because the very high power monsters will ignore you if you're too weak.
But even then, but you're missing out on a turn.
Yes, and that only checks your level. So if you've leveled up a ton, but you haven't collected enough items to be competent, then those monsters will wipe you out way too early in the game.
Likewise, you could get, you know, you could be level 9 and get a level 2 monster.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, you can just be, like, middle of the pack and get a class that nobody else has.
Yeah, I've definitely seen one game where a player was level 9 and everybody else was around level 8 or 7, so they weren't close to taking the 10th level. They picked up a monster and it was, like, level 6. Everyone dumped a bunch of stuff onto it. In the end, they weren't able to defeat it, but they weren't knocked down any level, so they stayed at level 9. Then it went around the table. Everyone drew cards so that they could have more stuff to stop the level 9 character when it got back to their turn. It got back to their turn, and they drew a card, and it was a level 1 monster.
Yeah.
And it didn't matter what anybody could do at that moment, because the level 1 monster, no matter how strong it ended up getting, just didn't stand a chance against this level 9 player. And it was just a total luck of the draw. Yeah, it's totally random. There's the and that's all due to that all generates these pacing problems, where somebody who just gets a couple good draws in a couple turns, like someone who draws the level 1 and level 2 monsters at the beginning of the game, can get very far ahead because they're collecting treasures and levels, and other people just kind of get pushed behind because they just can't catch a break with monsters, you know?
Yeah, and even with that, like, if you fall behind, usually there's not much you can do to actually win.
Really? The only thing you can do to catch up is to ask to help other people and get items from them. But because you're behind, you're less likely to be
of use.
Because there's times when your power level is so low that even if you helped defeat a monster, you wouldn't actually help to defeat them. The monster would still have too high a power. And so that person fighting it has to go to somebody with other higher power to help them out. In that case, they probably don't need your help. They can just use one other ally.
You really get left behind in
a
way.
Yes, it's unfortunate. And there's really nothing else that can help you there. That said, there are a lot of cards in the game that are just like nuke buttons that can just like totally end a fight and, you know, put everyone's efforts to waste. Like, for instance, there is the polymorph cards, which will turn a monster into a harmless thing, and it will end the fight, and you won't fight the monster, and you won't get the treasure. And these are very powerful ways of stopping someone from winning a big fight. And so it can nuke, and it can set back, or at least it can stop the person who's fighting the monster with a single card. But what it can also do is you can use it to bait out other people's modifier cards. So if you can imagine this scenario, that you and somebody else are level 9 and they're fighting the monster, you have this polymorph card, but you hold on to it for as long as you can. You wait for other people to buff up the monster. The person playing buffs himself up. Everyone's playing a tons of cards. Maybe like a dozen cards get played. And maybe it doesn't matter who's winning at that point because you just play your polymorph card. Now, all the cards that everybody else played, your opponents, the person fighting the monster, and the other people trying to stop him, all the cards they played are just totally useless. It's a total blowout in just a single card. There's a lot of cards that do this.
It becomes extremely high variance as to how you can impact the game or how, you know, whatever, basically. It's just very high variance.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing is that Munchkin is a competitive game that has weird implementation of cooperative elements. There are competitive cooperative games.
Mm-hmm.
I think Dead of Winter is one that comes to mind as, like, having a hidden traitor mechanic.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, everybody's on the same timer that you have to work on, you have to keep down.
Yeah, I think a funny thing about this game is that every time I've played it with a new group of people, like the first few monster encounters, people like just help fight it. They don't even ask for treasure, they just help. Even after I explained to them that you shouldn't do that, that you should at least ask for treasure, even after that they still help for nothing, or they'll help for just like one treasure. Like they don't really care. They just want to help, which is funny because the game, you know, you're technically a party of people. Like in any other game, in any other piece of entertainment, you know, fiction, books, movies, whatever, this group of people would be working together at all odds, at all costs, against all odds. But in this game, you are specifically trying to backstab each other. It presents itself in a really odd way.
It's also worth noting that, like, if you are, like, you know, trying to nickel and dime people for their treasure, the moment somebody basically does it for free, for whatever reason, it upsets the game's balance.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it completely changes how the game can play out in the future. And at that point, it's very easy to king make in this game. Because almost every card that can add power to a monster can also add power to a person. So, if you want, you can just choose not to, you know, try to win and make one person win.
Mm-hmm.
there's some, like, of these political style games that do this, and some have ways around it. I think this game's particularly annoying about it, though, because if you are not on the side of the king-making team or whatever, king-making being multiple people trying for one of those people to win, you know, so, like, two people playing in a group of four, and one person's trying to help another person win, so it's, like, playing against two people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, like, you know, like, it can get really annoying if you're not on that side, because, like I said, it feels like the other player has so much better odds because they literally have another player helping them. In a way, if you can't win or you're really far behind, there's, like, no incentive not to king make.
Mm-hmm. Except for the fact that, I mean, like, you might just be bitter the whole time.
Right.
And you just kind of want to screw everybody over, including the king.
So this is personally something that I don't like. I don't know how much of this is opinion, how much is really bad game design, but mm-hmm. I am not a big fan of games that try to incorporate real life into the game.
Okay.
I think there's definitely room for it. So, like, I mean, there's games like Werewolf where that's the whole point.
Yeah, well, I think
that's fair, but yeah, Munchkin...
if it's a point, it's good. If it's a well-utilized mechanic, it's good. Mm-hmm. But then it's like Munchkin, where it feels bad to do the kind of real-life things. Yeah. Like, owning the game is something that I think comes up, right? Or maybe I'm thinking of something else.
I mean...
wearing the shirt or whatever.
Yeah, I think... And not just that, but, like, you know, real-life... talking to people and stuff like that.
Okay, fair enough.
And, like, being willing to help people outside of game for benefits in the game.
Mm-hmm.
Or, like, for the, I guess, the magic circle sort of concept of everybody trying to win. Like, once somebody tries not to win in Munchkin, then the whole game becomes pointless, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Sure.
This is a game that is held on the idea that the players all want to win equally.
Yeah, it is kind of like a delicate balance. And if the players all want to win equally, then when they ask to help people, they'll be doing, like, they'll have competitive rates.
Yeah.
It's like you can crumble that whole economy just by doing it for free for no reason, or by always doing it for just one treasure, you know? No one's ever going to choose anybody else if you're always willing to do it for just one treasure, even if you're doing pretty well in the game. It just, like, dismantles that agreement. I wanted to say something again, to go back to the point of helping people, or to the topic of helping people. It's very funny that this is even part of the game, because if you think about it like this, so you start a game, you sit down, you say it's competitive, you deal people their cards, and depending on what cards they get, a player may only be able to do two things. When it's their turn, they fight a monster. When it's not their turn, they can help people. That's it. That's all the character's actions. There's nothing that they can do to hurt people. It's not a mechanic in a game for somebody if they're dealt the wrong cards, which can happen oftentimes in this game. So it's a competitive game where you can't compete.
Yeah.
It's a competitive game where you can't interact with people. The only way you can interact with people is to help them. So that's just contradictory right there.
Yeah.
A player playing this game has no ability to do what the game is telling him to do, which is backstab.
Yeah.
I think that's hilarious.
Yeah.
And it's unfortunate.
You know, I mentioned the t-shirt and the bookmark. I know the shirt specifically says that if you are wearing this when you play a game of Munchkin, you can show that you are wearing it before the game begins to, like, gain an extra level or something.
Uh-huh.
There's literally outside pay-to-win advantages.
Right, and, you know, we all love those, right?
And, you know, going back to just sort of, like, the atmosphere and the out-of-game gameplay aspect... It almost feels like it under-explains cards and rules to make players argue.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it also says, like, you can cheat if you don't get caught in the game's rulebook.
Yeah. I mean...
I do understand what the intention of this game is. And that sort of goes back to, like, the whole product of its time.
You could see the intention from the game when it comes to the name of the game.
Yeah.
Because a munchkin is a term from role-playing games like Dungeons & Dragons for somebody who is trying to win.
Yeah.
Which means that they're trying to be the best out of their party. They're trying to steal all the glory. They're doing everything they can. Maybe they're trying to break the game or at least be overpowered in the game. They're working against everybody, most importantly the dungeon master, but not including their allies. That's where the name Munchkin comes from. And so that's where the theme from the game comes from. And so it's kind of like this mindset that your gaming group has to have in order to actually play the game the way it's supposed to be played and to enjoy the game. It's like,
right, this
when
this...
we talk about like how we talk about games and why you play them, and we talk about that this is like a gaming hobbyist podcast. And some of it, you know, we spend a half of every episode talking about how to play the game and how to win at the game. And that's good for people who don't play a lot of games. It's good to help people get into the game. We want to convert people who don't play a lot of board games to play more board games by listening to this podcast. And this game, Munchkin, is only playable in an established group of gamers who are very... understand very well what this game is about.
What the game is about and how each other person in the group would react to the game.
Yes.
So, I also want to get to one of two big points.
Okay.
We briefly touched on one of them, which was that it's sort of a victim of its timing.
Mm-hmm.
But also, is the game satire? This is, I think, a question that bounces around my head in a million ways.
Well, obviously, everything in the game, like the artwork and the names and everything, is all satire.
Yeah, and
it's
there's,
very obviously
there's a lot
satire.
Of, like, jokes and parodies mm-hmm. and weird references, like the gazebo,
yeah.
which is, like, a forum story.
Yeah, yeah, they make a lot of references to, like, Dungeons, early Dungeons and Dragons internet forum posts that got shared around a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, you mentioned the gazebo, which is a story about a player who did not understand what a gazebo was, and so they just assumed it was a monster that they had to fight.
Yeah. And then you look at, like, the fact that there are pay-to-win aspects. It could be taken as a, you know, satire, like we're making fun of expansions and pay-to-win stuff.
I mean, in the base game, there is a card called Cheat.
Yeah.
Which allows you... The card allows you to wield a weapon that's not usable for your class or race.
It doesn't actually let you cheat.
But I mean, it's called Cheat.
Yeah.
Like, they know what they're doing. And so, I guess you could say, like... You know, the theming is a satire, so maybe the gameplay is sort of a satire on gameplay. I mean, it certainly is a satire.
I mean, it's
on
definitely
the dynamics of a real adventuring party in Dungeons and Dragons. They're always trying to help each other. In this game, you should always be trying to backstab each other.
I think then it's still worth noting that, like, just because it's satire doesn't mean it's good game.
Yes.
it's like somebody trying to say, you know, hey, I don't want to be rude, but, and then they say something rude.
Exactly.
Like, your previous statement did not undercut the, you know.
I get it. It's like, yeah, you could say, like, oh, I'm going to make a satire on this, but, like, is it still on its own enjoyable enough to actually watch? You know, is all of its merit just on the fact that it's a satire? Because if it is, then it's probably not a good game, especially when the thing you're satirizing is being a cooperative party, and you're doing so by making people be nasty to each other.
And then the other point, if you don't have any other quite bullet points, is that, so, Munchkin came out 2001. If you look at other, like, popular board games, a lot of the gateway games we talked about came out around, like, between 2003 to 2008.
Mm-hmm.
And personally, I would say that sort of renaissance explosion of board games and the popularity came,
you know,
like...
most notably, Catan came out around then.
Well,
right?
It came out in 95.
It came out in 95, very... But it gained a lot of popularity in North America,
like,
around that time.
Especially between, like, 07 to 2013... is where I would personally put
sure.
it, you know, me as a historian. But like, it came out before that. It came out before a lot of, like you said, the developments, the new conventions, the concepts people had. But
yeah,
it
like
also
tempo, pacing, catch-up, mechanics.
Different forms of setup and deck structure and game structure.
Yeah.
But then, when you think about it, like, it came out before board gaming was really that big. I don't think it was ever meant to be as popular as it is. You know, there's so many versions and expansions, and, like, if you go to, like, I know in our local game store we go to the most, there's just this, like, pillar rotating kiosk thing of just Munchkin products.
Mm-hmm.
And it amazes me that it is that popular, because it really shouldn't be.
Well,
it's not meant for the normal gaming crowd. It's not meant for new gamers.
I think what it's really meant for, and it's sold in the same places where this other product is it's for Dungeons and Dragons True. Parties. It's like, it's a game that you can play maybe in between, before or after D&D sections, or it's a game you can play if you don't have enough time for a D&D session, yeah. but you still want to get that kind of fantasy feel. And it's also good for a group of people that have the kind of rapport that a D&D party would have.
But
you know,
it feels like the opposite, that it's become so popular with people that just play normal board games and card games.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, maybe it was intended for these people. I mean, it has all these in-jokes right. that only a D&D crowd would understand.
Exactly.
But then, you know, because it's just this simple, digestible game with a pretty popular theme to it, it doesn't have the intense book reading depth that Dungeons & Dragons have.
Yeah.
It's just got a very easy rule set, and, you know, it's a very fast, simple card game. You know, it's obvious why this has the potential to grow to a wider audience.
I see why it did so, because it was more or less the only thing to fit that mm-hmm. around at the time. I'm saying it came out at the right time, which was also the wrong time. It was the right time for it to become popular, but the wrong time for it to become popular because it reached a different audience.
Maybe the audience also didn't know any better.
Oh, maybe.
The game doesn't know better, and the audience doesn't know better.
I don't even know. It's an enigma.
I think there's one last thing that I want to talk about, and that's a couple house rules to fix Munchkin, to make it just a little more playable.
Sadly, this is a game that you need to do game design work, but hey, maybe this is your first practice run.
And you briefly mentioned how at its time we didn't have a lot of the preconceptions of games, board gaming, that they had when this game was developed.
Yeah.
And so, for example, you mentioned multiple decks, because this game says, you know, it tried to make it as simple as it could by putting the monsters and the character classes and races in the same deck, which is wrong. I mean, anyone designing a game now would never do that. They would obviously make the class deck, the race deck, and the monster deck.
Or not even a deck, just deal out classes and races.
Exactly. And maybe the game decided...
That's almost like an auto-include in every game now, is like, give players an identity.
Right, exactly. So maybe Steve Jackson was thinking that, like, that was too complicated to write all that out in the rules. Let's just put it in one deck, and if you draw it, you get it. Plus, I mean, you're dealt a couple cards at the beginning of the game. So what we suggest, or what I suggest at least, to make it a little more playable is certainly separate the race and class cards from the deck of monster cards and otherwise, and deal those out at the beginning of the game so that each player does have an identity. Technically, there's cards that pertain to being human, which means you don't have a race. You can either take those out of the game as well, because you will never be a human. If your race changes, you always just draw a new race card, so you always have a race to you. Or you can leave them in and just give players the option of foregoing their race for a time to be a human for the purposes of those items. I just take them out.
Yeah.
Deal people race and class cards. Never be without one. If you lose one, you just get another one later on. And then I think we also sometimes do the option where, you can choose not to kick down the door and instead just draw an item card. I've heard that rule before. Also heard the rule before. No, that's not the rule. I remember it now. It's, if you kick down the door and you fail to fight a monster, then you can choose to instead draw a card from the item deck. The normal rule is if you fail to fight a monster, then you draw a card from the door deck and add that to your hand in addition to whatever you just encountered, unless it was a trap. So in the game, you can only draw door cards that way. In my house rule, you can also draw item cards that way, just so you have access to equipment earlier on more frequently, which is always a good balancing thing.
I mean, personally, I would also, like, have sort of like Pandemic, where you shuffle the easy monsters and then the hard monsters in a separate thing, then put the easy on top of the hard.
Yeah, that would at least help with pacing, and you would get to the harder monsters later in the game. And then those harder monsters tend to give you multiple levels and way more items than the weaker monsters. So it's better to have those later, just in case somebody has that magical card that lets him defeat a powerful monster and get a whole bunch of items in a surprising way.
Yeah, I think really that I do want to bring up that if you are learning game design or if you just went to practice game design, it's always a good idea to try to look at a game that you have that isn't perfect, which is all games, really.
Yeah.
And then, you know, think about what kind of rule you could change, either to make it better or to see how it plays out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's just sort of a good experiment, and this is definitely a game you can do that.
Yeah, too. And then obviously play test it.
Yeah.
Now, here's a house rule that I have not play tested because I came up with it today while I was thinking about this game, and that is to reverse the way that helping works. So rather than your opponents having the option of suggesting that they help you and naming their price, instead, the rule is that only the person fighting the monster can ask for help, and they have to ask for the price as well. Because if you think about it, if somebody offers to help for free, why not? It's free help. If you ask someone to help you for free, then that's rude.
Yeah.
No one would ever take that deal. You're asking for free help? No way.
That's
You better sweeten that deal a little more.
That's an interesting way to reverse the social dynamic.
Yeah, exactly. It reverses the dynamic. And, you know, if you just think about it like I just described it, it kind of makes sense that the transactions in that point would become more transactional, you know. It'd be more important, like, I don't know. I don't know if I want to help you because, really, what do I stand to gain from it? As opposed to, oh, yeah, I can help you, whatever. Yeah. I'm up for it, you know. So yeah, that's my untested house rule. If you have Munchkin or if you get Munchkin after listening to this episode, I ask you that you maybe give that a shot and see what happens.
My untested house rule is put all the consumable items in a separate item deck from the equipment.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
I mean, it's untested, but...
But, yeah, I mean, it's the same idea as what we're talking about with the races and classes, and that it gives players a little more ability to determine what kinds of items they get. At least with that modification to the game, when it comes to the late game, you've got plenty of equipment. What you really need is consumables that help you interact with other opponents and also temporarily boost your abilities for a crucial combat. Yeah, they're way more important then. So why not give them their own deck? And then when it comes to those last rounds around the table, when people are hitting level 9 and they're about to hit level 10, like when I described before, when a player almost won, but everybody blew all their consumables, then it got around to them and they were able to beat a level 1 because the people hadn't been able to recover the number of consumables that they had used. With this modification, then maybe they would have.
Yeah.
And the game would have continued. Yeah.
All right.
Interesting. Yeah. So that is our episode on Munchkin.
Yeah.
The sympathetic roast of Munchkin.
Yeah.
We hope we brought a little bit of a different energy to this one and you found it exciting.
I thought it was exciting recording it.
Yeah, it was fun kind of picking this game apart. So everybody, if you would like, you can check out
I did want to say...
Oh, we should probably also do the similar games.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's a lot of games with a similar concept of playing with how, you know, even just dungeon crawling card games.
Yeah.
Like, there's One Deck Dungeon is a really popular one.
Mm-hmm.
I think my one that I want to bring up that I haven't played but I know about is Role Player. It is a satire of RPGs like Dungeons and Dragons, but it makes fun of how long and arduous the process of character creation can be. So in Role Player, the whole game is making a character.
Okay.
And it's like a engine builder resource management thing where the whole point of the game is to make the strongest character.
Okay. That's funny.
Yeah.
I like that. We should check out that game in the future. Role Player. All right. Thank you for listening.
Yep.
That was our episode on Munchkin. If you like the episode, or you want to just shout out to us or give us some comments, you can leave them on whatever podcast listening app you listen to us on, or you can, hit us up on social media. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook at BG Broscast.
Yep.
We also have a website, bgbcast.com, where we post all our episodes and give them tags and descriptions, and you can check that out if you're looking for a particular game and hearing our thoughts on it, or you just want to go through our back catalog. It's there, in addition to on podcasting apps.
Yep.
If you're interested, to going to a URL that we just give you the name of. You can also check out our friend's website, entertainthegeeky.com. It's where our friends Chris, Roger, and Jason post their podcast. They host their podcast there. They have podcasts about nerd culture, nerd news, all kinds of stuff happening over there. They also have a blog where they post a couple things every now and then. And that's also where hopefully soon you can find information regarding our Kickstarter, which is coming soon. It's starting to get towards the end of June. We said it would be in June, but
we're working on it.
And we just know that we will get it to you as soon as you can, and we'll get that information to you regarding it as soon as you can. But what we can tell you now is that the Kickstarter will be kickstarting our board game producing company, as well as our first game, which is Conniving Cooks.
A bluffing and deduction card game for 2 to 6 players, in which players play as chefs at a high-class restaurant trying to get each other fired while making sure the guests get their food on time.
Mm-hmm. You know, you can look forward to that, but if you're interested in getting a game right now designed by us, you can check out Merle's Truck Stop in Maine on that website. It's a one-page role-playing game with a horror theme perfect for the merry month of June, and it is free right now if you use promo code Geeky.
G-E-E-K-Y.
That classic podcast advertising technique of spelling the promo code. That's, again, promo code Geeky.
And we're doing our best to get shirts out as well.
Oh, yeah. The printer has the files. I think they just need to be put up on a storefront.
Okay.
From our buddies Chris and Roger, they have a storefront for merch, and our stuff can be found at their storefront, which should be accessible through their website soon. We'll let you know through social media exactly when that happens. I just wanted to say real quick about Merle's Truck Stop in Maine. The free RPG day was like last week, and I ran a session of Merle's Truck Stop in Maine there with a couple people, and it was a lot of fun. I won't give any spoilers, but I will say that the day was saved. Chaotic alien coffee machines were overrunning a town, and they had to summon the eternal hipster in order to save the world. It was fun.
Sounds real fun.
Yeah. So check out that game, and stay posted for new episodes and more information from us, the Board Game Bros.
Yep.
Thanks for listening.
See ya.